Here's your host, Barb Adams.
All right, everybody, I've got a question for you. What do Aldous Huxley, you know, Brave New World, Nobel laureate Francis Crick, Apple founder Steve Jobs, and Timothy Leary all have in common? Time's up. Well, if you guessed they all use psychedelics, and on more than one occasion, you'd be right. My guest for this half of the show is America's leading and most respected authority on psychedelics, Dr. James Fadiman. Dr. Fadiman is a psychologist and professor at the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology, which he helped found in 1975. He's been involved in totally legal psychedelic research since the 1960s and has written a new book called The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide. If you would like more information about Dr. Fadiman and his research and books, please visit his website at psychedelicexplorersguide.com. Again, psychedelicexplorersguide.com. You can also check him out as well as his own personal website, jamesfadiman.com, and it's F-A-D-I-M-A-N. Welcome to America Now, James.
Well, what a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you so much. How and where did you originally get involved in psychedelic research?
Well, I was an undergraduate at Harvard, and I had a favorite professor named Richard Alpert, who became Ram Dass.
Wow.
And I was off after college working in Paris, and he came through with Aldous Huxley and Timothy Leary on their way to the first conference that they were going to present about psychedelics. And I didn't know anything about anything, and he said to me, his kind of undergraduate friend, the greatest thing in the world has happened to me, and I want to share it with you. And, you know, what are you going to say? So I said yes, and he reached into his jacket pocket and came out with a little vial of pills, and I thought, I have no idea what is going on here. And a few hours later, I had a better idea.
That's great. Yes, a more enlightened view of what was going on, right?
Well, I found that the world was a little wider and a little more deeper and a lot more interesting than I thought.
So how safe would you say psychedelics really are? Because I think there has been quite a resurgence recently of psychedelic drugs, including LSD.
Well, there's been a resurgence of research. The thing that is fascinating is in the 40 years when research wasn't allowed, 23 million Americans, just Americans, tried LSD. And that number goes up about 400,000 to 600,000 a year right now.
Wow.
So the question of how safe it is we haven't heard in the news for years of a fatality. And that isn't totally true. I can think of one high school kid who jumped off of a something that turned out to be a lot farther down than he thought. But he'd also never used psychedelics before and was very confused. They're not, they are definitely safe as chemicals. Used in the wrong way, in the wrong situation, they can be very dangerous.
So what are some of those dangerous situations then? What are some of the wrong uses?
Well, I'm very aware that these are not like other chemicals. They're not like other substances. The set and setting, meaning your mental attitude and the situation you take it in, makes all the difference. And if you're in an unsafe situation with people who you don't trust or don't like, and you don't know your way around how to use these, you can get in very serious trouble.
Yeah, so essentially your first time, fortunately, my gosh, you with Richard Alpert, Ram Dass, I mean, it probably doesn't get any better as far as guidance on your voyage with something like that.
Well, let's say it was a good way to start, and it convinced me that if you're going to use these substances, that they need to be used safely, and they need to be used for maximum benefit.
So is this why you wrote the book, to get the research out there and also to help prepare people if they do want to become, so to speak, a new voyager out there?
Well, Barb, you couldn't have said it better. Basically, if you're going to do something like this, and does it matter, And the answer is it matters enormously. I did some research once and asked 100 people who had LSD once in a safe, guided setting, how important was this experience in your life? 78% said it was the single most important experience of your life.
Really?
And when you get that kind of an overwhelming number, you say, well, gee, then might it be worth it to really do it carefully and well? And so that's really what the book is mainly for, is so people can understand if they're going to use these, and they are illegal, that they should use them as safely and as well as possible.
Yeah, exactly. And there's been an amazing number of people, as I mentioned in the beginning, and you've mentioned as well, who we really know and look up to as far as the people who have made huge differences in our world. Obviously, Steve Jobs, you know, Sir Francis.
Well, my favorite headline after Steve passed was, he got LSD, we got the iPhone. which is a little bit of a push, because as far as we know, he really didn't use LSD all the time for his, you know, his breakthroughs. But early in his life, it gave him an orientation that his life was to be of some service to as many people as possible. And that's very typical of people who've had a very fine LSD experience.
So then, but on the other side of it, if we're talking about 23 million people who have already experimented with the substance, not all of them invented iPhones. So maybe, it's more the rare case that may have this wonderful experience where they are becoming more aware of what their purpose is and problems.
Well, the wonderful experience is not that unusual. The also being a genius probably helps. And so we see it in the arts, I see it in medicine, I see it in law. And what's remarkable is how many people of your really quite varied listening audience are right now nodding and saying, oh yeah, I have had that experience at some level myself.
Yeah, and there are many different types of experiences people can have. I want to go back, though, with all the people that try these, and again, trying something that is illegal, potentially, but are they addictive?
Well, that's a fascinating thing with psychedelics, is they're anti-addictive, in that if you take a psychedelic on day one, and let's say you have a really positive experience, you say, wow, I'd like that again. Then you take a psychedelic on day two, nothing happens. And if you take it on day three, nothing happens. And it's quite a while before your system will allow anything to happen.
Wow.
And, of course, some of the people that I've worked with over, you know, many, many years, who took it once, say, 40 years ago, and it was an incredible creative breakthrough for their career, and they never used it again.
All right, we will continue this discussion with Dr. James Fadiman on psychedelics when America Now returns after this break. We are talking psychedelics and psychedelic research tonight with my guest, America's leading authority on psychedelics and psychedelic research, Dr. James Fadiman. And if you'd like to call in and ask a question tonight, 800-259-5791. Dr. Fadiman, I've got to ask you, though, with the visionary experiences and the really, pardon the pun, high experiences that people have with the LSD, can this come from other hallucinogens as well, like, say, psilocybin mushrooms or peyote or some of those types of psychedelics?
Absolutely.
Okay.
The chemistry of, there's kind of groups of psychedelics, but you've mentioned all the ones that I know the best, which is psilocybin is just like LSD in its effect, only it takes a few hours less. Mescaline from the peyote cactus, about the same as LSD. And then there are a host of other psychedelics that have very different experiences. But these are all dependent on really how high the dose and how safe the setting.
Yeah, so there obviously in your research you've looked at the different types of dosing with psychedelics, and they can be used for different types of activities. What are some of those things, and what are some of the doses that psychedelics can be applied to?
Well, I'll be speaking in doses that either your audience will understand or not, but a high dose is 400 micrograms. That's millionths of a gram. That's about if you broke the tip off of a very sharp pencil. That's a very large dose. And that's the dose in which people have repeatedly classical mystical experiences of unity or being united with God or however they explain it. When you get down to 200 or so micrograms, then people are using that very effectively in all kinds of psychotherapeutic ways. The most best research was really on long-term, hard-to-treat alcoholics with about a 50% success rate and other conditions. Go down to 100 micrograms, and this is something that very little research was done because the government just stopped it at the wrong time. That's the creative problem-solving breakthrough level. And that's where, for example, Crick, who gave us DNA and the double helix, he first saw the double helix with that kind of low dose. And then way down there, there's something called a microdose, which is 10 micrograms, which has no visual excitement, no pretty colors, nothing wobbles. And that's very new research that I'm kind of doing a national study on, where people are taking that little, and they report basically they have their normal day, but that it's just a little better, a little more effective. They're a little kinder. They can do one more set of reps at the gym. They can work a little more focused. And so those are really the four basic areas. And I left out, of course, recreational use because so many, many, many people have so much to say about it, and I have nothing really to add to that.
Yeah, you were talking about the microdoses of psychedelics and people actually using them in the workplace.
Absolutely, because nothing happens to them perceptually. As one of the people said to me, the rocks don't glisten even a little. And so we're talking way below what's called sub-perceptual. It's below perception. And the man who invented LSD said it was a very under-researched area, and that it seemed to be something that people have taken, not every day, but every couple of days, and no addiction and nothing special except at the end of the day. You know, there are days where at the end of the day you say, you know, that was a really good day. That seems to be the basic report I've had. And some people have written me and say, I think this, it doesn't work for me at all, I don't like it, and I'm not going to use it. And so far, no one has written in and said they had any serious problems because they're taking so little.
So
again,
basically
10 micrograms, 10 millionths of a gram.
Wow, that's low. So basically what I'm hearing you saying is that potentially microdoses of, say, a psychedelic then might be able to replace things like antidepressants or anti-anxieties, which are highly addictive and have terrible side effects.
Well, that's why it's nice to be on a show like yours, where I don't have to say that because you do it for me.
But it would
Let
be true, wouldn't it?
The idea that something could replace some very, very expensive, lifelong, and not very good for you pharmaceuticals is very intriguing. And I'm interested in seeing where that goes. Most of the research has been done, obviously, with higher doses with very serious conditions. There's wonderful work done with people with stage 4 cancer, meaning they're terminal. And they're also very sad and depressed, not surprising. But given psilocybin in a very safe, supportive setting, they feel incredibly better about themselves. They know they have a few months of life, and they cherish it, and they enjoy it. And they're loving towards their family, and there's an incredible reversal of the sorrow and fear around their own death.
So, Dr. Fanwin, what areas of the brain do these psychedelics then affect?
Well, the answer is, if we'd had the right to research this for the past 40 years, I'd give you an easy answer. It seems to excite the visual cortex. It seems to relax some of the emotional areas. And if I were to give you a highly technical answer, it would only because I'd be pretending I know what I'm talking about.
So we've only got about a minute or so here before we have to go to another break, but I want to start in on this one. What happened that the government basically started banning psychedelic research? Why was it at first approved, and then why was it banned?
Oh, I think we're going to have to wait till after the break on that one because it's complicated. But basically, the government didn't know quite what to do with something that seemed to also have a profound spiritual effect.
Uh-oh, yeah.
And when the government doesn't know what to do, their first kind of thrashing around is, well, why don't we ban it and then think about it?
Yeah, that quick reaction, as well as when we're talking about the psychedelics being also good for problem solving and things like that, perhaps it's as much as, maybe they don't want us thinking as much as we would like to be thinking for ourselves, potentially. I'm just putting that out there.
Well, I think, that may be possible. I don't think the government understood that part. They just saw that a lot of people who were mad at the government for, say, making the Vietnam War and a few other things, also liked psychedelics.
And so
they were frightened.
Yeah.
Just like the Occupy people are frightening people now.
Exactly. All right, hold those thoughts and we will come back to this. All right, America Now continues with Dr. James Fadiman. Stay tuned. All right, we are talking psychedelics and psychedelic research tonight with Dr. James Fadiman. He is America's leading and most respected authority on psychedelic drugs. If you'd like to call in tonight, 800-259-5791. And James, we had left off, you were talking about why the government was banning the drugs, and how did this affect your research? Because obviously, if I read this correctly, you started your research in the 60s, and then...
Oh, yes, I was, as were many people, I was a legal researcher, an experimental drug license to look at a drug that wasn't for sale, and we were all exploring and discovering. And we were actually doing work with senior scientists on creative problem solving with enormous and kind of startling success. And we got a letter from the government that said, as of the receipt of this letter, your research is canceled. And at that time, that day, we had four scientists in the next room just about to sit them up and work on their problems. And I looked at the letter and I said to my little team, and I was the youngest member, I think we got this letter tomorrow. Which we decided we did. But the government basically was, the 60s were a very wild time because people were questioning the value of the military, the value of the educational establishment, the value of the economic system, the value of all kinds of things. And the people who were running the top of the country said, you know, we really don't need anything that is like this, especially since it's our own children who are coming home and saying to, you know, Dad, the banker, I don't think this is a healthy thing for you to be doing, Dad. So they were frightened. And when a government is frightened, it reacts and overreacts and overreacts. And so they thought somehow that by banning something, it would go away. And all they could do to ban was us legal researchers. So us legal researchers all went out of business, and illegal use, of course, only increased.
Yeah, a lot of logic used there, I think, not.
Well, it's let us say that prohibition should have told us something. And there's a little favorite prohibition story. Before prohibition, if you draw a circle around Times Square about a mile, there were 800 drinking establishments. And then prohibition happened. And in the middle of prohibition, you took the same circle, 2,500 drinking establishments. So that was prohibition of alcohol, and prohibition of psychedelics and marijuana has worked about as well.
Exactly. Janice, do you see a correlation to what's going on now? We seem to be questioning everything as well. Again, we've got Occupy Wall Street. We've got, you know, people questioning the level of education in America anymore, et cetera, et cetera, and the government especially.
It looks like we are, again, getting into a period where we're saying if the basic institutions aren't working, doing more of the same thing isn't going to be successful. And that really is the fundamental question. And then the hard question is, well, how do you replace it? And the answer is with difficulty. And that's where we are, where we were in the 60s. But in the 60s, we came up with the ecology movement, the civil rights movement, women's liberation. We really made changes fueled by psychedelics of basic ways of looking at human beings that were all very positive, that we're all very proud of having done. And here we are again.
So if here we are again, do you see then a resurgence of psychedelics playing a role in what's happening once again?
Well, again, it isn't psychedelics, but those 23 million people, when you talk to them, as I do on a pretty daily basis, they say, you know, let me rethink some of these things. Especially, they're saying we need to rethink our relationship to nature. And, you know, you ignore nature, and eventually nature says, I actually am a zillion times more stronger than you are, and I'm taking over. But if you say we're part of nature, which is obvious, then you begin to figure out how do you cooperate? How do you make things work both for yourself and for the other species, and for the plankton, and so forth and so on.
So it can help.
And the
help
psychedelics
us.
Do seem to be fueling that, in that the people I talk to in most of these areas often say, no, I don't use psychedelics. And I say, did you ever? And they say, well, yeah. And that's actually when I dropped out of law school and went into biology because of that, and so forth. So we're seeing people whose orientation, like Steve Jobs, was in many cases shifted by their use of psychedelics. And they think that working for a better, healthier, saner world is the only obvious thing to do.
It's about learning to become in balance with everything there is, about being in harmony with nature and all that is.
Well, as someone pointed out to me, if we breathe out, plants breathe it in. And what plants breathe out, we breathe in. It's the most basic relationship between living systems. So if you harm the plants, as we're learning, you harm the air, and you breathe in bad air, and you get sick.
So, James, as far as the research goes right now, are you currently conducting research again? Is it legal again?
Well, there is legal research going on. There's legal research going on with the cancer I mentioned. There's research going on with post-traumatic stress disorders, with cluster headaches, with obsessive-compulsive behavior. There are other research projects. I'm not a physician, and I'm not affiliated with a research institution. So my research is basically asking people, what are they doing? And that research turns out to be fascinating because I end up finding out who the 23 million are. And there's amazingly little that's been researched about them.
So what type of information then, as far as besides just finding out that they've used them, what else are you gathering from these people?
Well, that's actually the first question is I talk to a group of, say, students, and I say, have any of you used psychedelic drugs? And everybody raises their hand. And then I give them a little handout and say, could you just check off the ones you've used? And I'm astounded by how much use there is among, say, college-age students. And then the next question is, what are you using it for? And the answers are fun. The next answer, however, is self-discovery. And then the next answer is healing. And the next answer is spiritual awareness.
Great.
So these are the uses that people are attempting to use these substances for. And so, you know, my book says, hey, if you're going to get serious, here's some information which, sadly enough, the government hasn't given you. And even kind of nice places like student health centers still tend to not quite understand well enough how to help students with these substances.
So there are obviously research-based benefits that have been found with the psychedelics. Can you address
them? Well, let me give
you
one that's easy. Johns Hopkins University did a study, and they said, what would happen if we gave psilocybin, the mushrooms, the chemical from the mushrooms?
We're going to have to hold it there, James. Sorry about that.
Okay.
All right, we will pick up about psilocybin on the other side of the break when America Now continues with Dr. James Fadiman. All right, my guest for this half of the show is Dr. James Fadiman, and we are talking about his book, The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide, Safe, Therapeutic, and Sacred Journeys. And again, if you're considering doing these types of journeys, then I would highly recommend you get the book, because it's very important that you understand what you need to be doing and how it's important to have a really good guide with you, someone who can keep you calm throughout this process. Right, Dr. Fadiman?
Absolutely. It's the same thing as if you want to fly an airplane. You know, you don't go down to the airfield and say, I'd like to fly an airplane. They say, well, here's some keys, catch. There's a couple of planes out there. Have a good time. They say, wait a moment, this is actually pretty serious. Let's make sure you know what you're doing, and that you have someone with you to help you learn. And
exactly.
We were talking at the break about the psilocybin experience at Johns Hopkins, where they gave very healthy volunteers who had interest in spiritual issues psilocybin in a setting which was safe and therapeutic and oriented towards the sacred. And to nobody's great surprise, but the delight of science, most of the people in the study had an important, meaningful, major spiritual experience. And what is important is they were asked a year later, and they indicated that the effects of the experience had lasted. Now, this isn't about a chemical. It's about a learning experience. And that's the real difference between psychedelics and other substances, is you have an experience in which there's learning.
Yeah, totally different from anything chemical. And with the chemicals, you've got, again, a lot of potential long-term negative effects. What about immediate and long-term effects, though, of psychedelic use, even for spiritual or therapeutic purposes?
Well, the short-term effects are, as I said earlier, for many people, in the spiritual realm at least, it's the most important or one of the most important experiences of their lives. In the therapeutic area, people used to talk about, well, one dose with psychedelics is worth a year or 2 years of conventional therapy. It's a way of talking. But it's really the experience of understanding yourself at a far different level than you've ever understood yourself before. So it's really about education. And how long does the effect last? Well, I watched some video footage of someone who took one session with LSD 40 years ago when he was a very, very serious alcoholic. And the interviewer said, well, have you drunk since then? The man looked at him and said, no, not at all, never. And the man said something about, wow, what willpower you must have. And the man just laughed and said, no, I have no interest in drinking. That's the shift that we're looking at.
Wow, that's powerful. That's quite the shift. So did he continue then doing the psychedelics, though, or do you know?
I lost you on that, Barb.
Oh, I said I was asking you if he continued doing the psychedelics then at that point rather than
taking... No, that's wonderful. No, he had one experience 40 years ago.
That was it, period.
That was it.
Wow.
But again, see, if you talk in learning, you know, you learned at some point, two and two is, my God, it's four. And 40 years later, you say, well, how much is two and two? You say, I, you know, there was no reason to unlearn it.
Exactly, exactly. Dr. Fannerman, there seems to be a lot of interest again right now amongst scientists, psychologists, and researchers, even spiritual healers, the beneficial uses for psychedelic substances. And you talk about 7 research-based benefits of psychedelics. Would you care to talk about those 7 benefits?
Well, that was kind of a little sampler, but we have talked about some of them because we're looking at, again, looking at how can people die more easily and more in a better frame of mind, which helps everyone. We're looking at cluster headaches. Cluster headaches are many, 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 many times worse than migraines. Mm. And conventional medicine really has almost nothing that helps. And much to our surprise, one dose of psychedelics often will prevent those headaches for months at a time.
Wow.
And we're looking, and that's a very small group. It's a kind of rare and horrible condition. But let's go to the other end, which is post-traumatic stress disorder. We're not using, in this case, the psychedelics we've mentioned so far. We're using MDMA, or what's called ecstasy. And that MDMA-assisted therapy, meaning it's part of a psychotherapy program with one or maybe two MDMA sessions. And in one of the studies where people had, again, been in treatment for years and years and years with terrible results, they're called treatment-resistant. That's a word the medical people like because it like blames the patient for not getting better. And 80% of the study, 80% of the people in the study, at the end of it had so few symptoms that they wouldn't have been allowed to enter the study. So let's talk big numbers. 700,000, that was 100,000 veterans, are returning with some level of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Mm.
And either we're going to truly care for our soldiers instead of just applauding when we say the word by offering them the best medical treatment available, or we're not.
Good for you. I'm glad to hear you say that because you're so correct. I've done a couple of shows on this with the post-traumatic stress disorder as well. You know, rather than just kind of turn a blind eye to them and say, well, good luck to you or whatever. You know, we welcome them home. Yay, you're home. But then they've got to deal with all this. We need to help these people through
their
experiences.
Well, let me give you the dirty little secret. There have been more suicides of returned soldiers.
Yeah.
From Iraq and Afghanistan than soldiers who were killed in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah, it's
and
shocking.
Again, the nice thing is we have something that appears to work. There's a study now going on with veterans, and the question is, at what point will the Veterans Administration, who are really good people, figure out, even if they think this is kind of woo-woo medicine and they don't understand it, and they say, but if people get better in one or two sessions or they don't get better with 30 years of treatment, just on a dollar for dollar basis, which do I think is a better idea?
Really? It just seems so, you know.
So what I'm saying is, if you can't appeal to people's kind of love of their own soldiers, you can appeal to saving money. So I'm giving something to both political parties here.
Yeah, and that's a good way to do it. So there are obviously other things that psychedelics can do in the therapeutic and psychological arenas as well. How about working through emotional and behavioral blocks? Or,
well, a lot of the work I did was with people who were what we would call a normal kind of outpatient, you know, unhappy with your job, unhappy with your life, not sure what you're here for. And what we found with those people is they had a large improvement in the way they treated themselves and other people. They had more friends at work. They spent more time with their kids. They enjoyed nature more. They basically seemed to be, in every way we could measure regular behavior, healthier. We also gave them some psychological instruments, and they showed improvement on that. But that's really, you know, who cares? What matters is, does your life work better? So, yes, there's a lot of research that says these can be used with moderately upsetting problems in life. And there is a reason we think why it works, is people get a different view of themselves, and they can see that their problems, their neuroses, their angers, are a smaller part of their total being, that they're actually more than just their personality. And again, we're edging in on the spiritual here. But when people see that they are more, and that the more they see is all seems to be healthier, they say, well, I'd rather identify with my healthier side. And they find it easier to do so.
Exactly. All right. We will continue our discussion with Dr. James Fadiman on the other side of the top of the hour break.
And now, here's your host, Barb Adams, and her guest, Dr. James Fadiman.
James, I've got to ask you on all of this. We were talking about the research-based benefits of psychedelics, and obviously it has great use and potential in therapy and getting people in touch with themselves. And I started thinking about this, being in touch with oneself. What about autism? Has there been psychedelic therapy used in autism?
Well, it was one of the great tragedies of having research stopped. There was research done in the 60s with severely autistic children. These were people who were fully institutionalized. They were the ones that we just felt we couldn't reach at all. And the research showed that it allowed these kids to reconnect to reality, to each other. And the one story that almost makes me cry when I tell it is a girl who had not spoken in several years was given LSD, and she's in this room with a researcher who's sitting quietly in a chair on one side of the room. And she comes over to him, and she puts her hand on his knee and looks up into his face and says, "We're all one, aren't we?"
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh.
So, of course, that's an area that I just love to see us do some work again, just to see if we can help these kids and help their parents.
So is there a possibility that something like this, that you will be able to get further funding for research, or is this something that's still being totally blocked?
Well, nothing is blocked anymore. It used to be that no matter what you did, the answer was no. Now the rule of thumb is, I'm going to put every imaginable kind of bureaucratic hurdle in your way, but they're all legitimate, and we'll delay kind of listening, you know, getting your forms back to you. But eventually, if you really do everything just right, we will allow you to use these substances again. And, of course, other countries are, you know, as is usual when the U.S. government is the last to find out, other governments are way ahead of us, both in the research and in stopping the kind of illegalization of things. And as people have said, you know, how can you make war against a mushroom?
Kind of seems like it would be difficult, doesn't it?
Well, it's been difficult, and the mushrooms seem to be proliferating. They're doing very well, thank you.
Let's hear it for the mushrooms, all right. You know, there's so many things out there that people can try. I guess, you know, if people were interested in having these types of experiences for one reason or another, whether in the extremely low microdoses you were talking about at the workplace, or having
right.
that full-blown get in touch with the divine within yourself and understanding your connection to the all, to the I am. What types of drugs, again, would you recommend? Is it always just strictly LSD, or would you recommend certain
medicines? Again, I'm a little nervous when the word recommend comes up.
Okay.
If these were legal.
Okay. True. All right. If they were legal.
I've written a bunch of books, as academics do, and this one is limited only to the things I knew something about. So it's rare in an academic book. So I'm limited to my understanding of LSD, psilocybin, mescaline, and the plants that they come from. And those have been proven, again, to be safe if used correctly and mentally very upsetting if used incorrectly.
Yeah, what are some of the settings that would be where they would be used incorrectly? I mean, what would set people off?
Well, incorrectly would be, I hate to do this because all your people listening who are recreational users would say, oh, man, he's so square. But if you're interested in getting something serious from them, a concert is not the best place. Nature, you know, quiet, beautiful nature is good. All the research studies work identically now. They all have a living room-like situation, which is as comfortable and as relaxed and as normal as is possible. And they have beautiful things on the wall, and they have flowers, and they're trying to make it as attractive and as easy an experience as you can have. And that seems to be the kind of step one, and also a place where you feel safe. And, of course, a place where you can turn your cell phone off and not be bothered.
So, again, something where it's very safe. You know the people that you are surrounded with as well.
Exactly. You not only know them, but you trust them.
Yeah.
And, hopefully, there are some of them that know a lot more than you do so that you're in good hands. We have for alcohol, we have designated drivers. And, really, with psychedelics, we need to have much more of designated guides. To protect people from harm, that's step one, but to allow benefit. And that's really, you know, where my interest is. And there are a lot of people who are interested in preventing harm, so I support all of them, but I don't have, you know, anything special to add to that. But the area in which I do know a lot about is how to use these well. You know, for if you're doing scientific problem solving, for example, you need a rather special setting.
Yeah, exactly. And again, that setting can influence things. What I heard you saying is it's very important because there are many factors that can influence the value and nature of that psychedelic experience and voyage.
Well, we forget about how important set and setting is. Imagine you're in a physician's office and you roll up your sleeve and you're given an injection and it's a little bit painful and you relax. And imagine you then are out on the street a week later and someone runs up to you and slams a needle in your arm. It's might be the same, you know, like flu vaccine. But boy, will you take it differently and will you get a different experience because the situation and set is different.
Yeah, exactly.
And I won't even go into the difference with set and setting when we're talking about sex because it's not this kind of program.
Well, we are in safe harbor at this point.
But again, you know, when I talk about set and setting and I say, you know, have you ever thought about sex? Everybody says, oh, set and setting.
Well, actually, yes, we were probably all kind of figuring that out. So enhances things. All right, we'll just leave it at that. A lot better than some of the other ones they sell out there and try to sell you for that. So, okay. Do you believe, James, that the psychedelic use should be really for about both the personal, scientific, and even spiritual freedom then, totally?
Well, yeah, I believe in what I consider basic human rights. And I have three that affect psychedelic research in particular. One is I think it's an inalienable human right to be able to be closer to divinity. I just think what we're here for.
Yes.
I also think that we should be allowed to understand the world as much as possible, which is what science is for. And I think that people should be allowed to explore their own consciousness as long as they're doing it safely. I think those are basic human rights. And the nice thing is what that means is you should have the freedom to use the best tools available. I mean, there are countries that have in their constitution where it's your right as a citizen to get the best available medical treatment that's out there. And so that's, for me, basic freedoms to see God, to see nature, and to see yourself.
Yeah, I would agree
and
with you.
I haven't
totally
found anyone yet who says, well, no, I'm against that.
Well, here's hoping not. Good grief. All right, we will continue this discussion on the Psychedelic Explorer's Guide with Dr. James Fadiman. We are talking psychedelic research and experiences tonight here on America Now with America's leading psychedelic researcher, Dr. James Fadiman. And if you'd like to join in, 800-259-5791. Dr. Fadiman, who shouldn't be taking these types of drugs? We, you know, we've been talking about having the right settings and the controlled substance and having someone there who knows how to guide you through this and all of that. But sure. Are there specific people that absolutely should never try these?
Well, I'm actually more conservative than that because a lot of people come up to me and say, well, I've been thinking of taking a psychedelic, but, and then I say, don't. And they say, well, I haven't told you my reason yet. I said, any reason you have that it doesn't feel right for you to do it, that's a good reason. Mm-hmm. And on the other side, people who have a major mental illness diagnosis shouldn't take psychedelics. Now, that doesn't mean that when we begin to allow the medical profession to use them, that there won't be ways in which those people can't perhaps be helped. But for now, since I'm really dealing with the fact that 99.99% of use is illegal, if you don't have your head on straight, so to speak, LSD is not going to straighten it. It's really a health experience. It's not something you take when you're super depressed or super angry or paranoid or schizophrenic or et cetera. So I'm really very, very clear that in spite of how positive I sound, and I am positive because my book is basically says I'm going to talk about the benefits. There's enough out there about how bad it is for you. But definitely it is not a everyone should try this. That's an absolutely, definitely no, no, no.
Yeah, exactly. And it's important, too, when we were talking about having a guided session, a controlled session, basically. Afterwards, after the session is finished, is there something where people can talk about it? I mean, do you encourage that people have, say, a post-experience integration then?
Absolutely, and it's a perfect word. People who, you know, when your sense of reality has been either expanded or changed or called into question, you are puzzled. You don't quite know what to do and what to say, and if you have friends around you who have been to that place before, it's much easier. And there's a World War I song which says it beautifully, which is, how do you keep them down on the farm after they've seen Harry?
Hmm.
How do you keep someone who's had a limited world view from having a difficult time adjusting when they return to, you know, their old world view? So, yes, integration turns out to be probably as important as the substance itself.
And as well, how long can some of these effects last? I mean, typically, how long does a voyage last? And then how long, again, would some of the effects of certain types of these psychedelic drugs last?
Sure. Well, the physical effect, this is what's quite remarkable. LSD actually leaves the body in about an hour and a half.
Wow.
Now, that's before the peak of the experience. So whatever's going on is your own chemicals rearranging themselves in a pattern which allows a wider range of experiences. That's the kind of simple way of saying it. LSD lasts about 8 to 12 hours, meaning you shouldn't drive, but you are basically in kind of normal awareness. Psilocybin lasts 6 to 8 hours. So that's the physical side. How long do the effects last? Well, again, we're back to a different model, which is, how long does learning last? And I gave you the example a while ago of someone who had LSD once in a wonderful setting with a great guide, and 40 years later, the effect lasts.
Yeah.
So that's probably the best answer, which is, learning lasts as long as you make use of the learning.
Excellent answer. I would agree with that. So as a researcher then, and especially with the probable and possible benefits here of psychedelic drugs in the medical field, should they be then made legal in the U.S. for medical research or even for spiritual work?
Well, it seems minimal to let us find out for what conditions are they most valuable. I mentioned earlier that they seem to have a remarkable effect on cluster headaches, for which we have nothing else that's very good. They MDMA-assisted psychotherapy seems to be remarkable for post-traumatic stress disorder. And the list is rather small of what we have done scientifically. But as with any other pharmaceutical, we keep trying to see how, you know, whether other conditions might be helpful. And to say to medical researchers, you can't research this because 40 years ago, the government was afraid of people being anti-war, it's not what we call scientific-based regulation. So what all my researcher friends say is, all we'd like is to do science exactly the way we do any other kind of science, which is as carefully as possible and as thoroughly as possible, and looking for all the possible negative side effects so that these materials can be used the way they're supposed to be. And that doesn't mean you go down to the corner drugstore. They're a little bit like a surgical instrument. Surgical instruments are not illegal, but they are limited to people who have been trained to use them. And for therapeutic use, that seems to be kind of normal, sensible, adequate behavior. Just like a massage license is limited to people who have enough skill to get a license. Doesn't mean other people can't rub other people, but if you're going to rub them for therapeutic health, you should know what you're doing.
I would agree with that totally, yes. And again, it would be the situation where the education, the training, all of that needs to be put in place, as well as just legalizing these psychedelic drugs.
And it is happening. There are a number of medical students. I'm part of a graduate student list of people who are doing research in these areas, and there are medical students and law students and biochemistry students. And they're all doing small research projects in some area of psychedelics that they're allowed to do. So we are moving forward. I'm not at all pessimistic. It's only it's hard to see continued unnecessary suffering.
Yeah, that is
and
really
let me just give you the kind of thing that I get in the mail.
You're going to have to hold that one. That's the teaser for when we come back after this break. Dr. James Fadiman, the Psychedelic Explorer's Guide, here on America Now. The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide, Dr. James Fadiman's most recent book. You can get it on his website, psychedelicexplorersguide.com, as well as amazon.com and other outlets if you're interested. And especially if you are interested in doing something along these lines, again, it is so important that you understand, one, yourself before you get into this. If you have any doubts, don't do it. And two, learn about this, research it. And the book is a great guide for safe, therapeutic, and sacred journeys. Again, The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide by Dr. James Fadiman. You are going to give me, or give the listeners as well as me, some examples and samples right before the break, so I'm going to let you pick it up there.
This is just out of my mailbox and never met the person. In the early 60s, I was a young, arrogant hoodlum and well down my road to alcoholism. Grew up in a little isolated fishing community where most of the adults are alcoholics. I was successfully falling down the same path and considered anyone in the world that was spiritual was either stupid or pretending. I was lucky enough to be given LSD, a large dose in a secure setting with a friend's wife as a guide. I was given more information on that trip than I could handle, and beauty so stunning I was embarrassed to look. Within days, the taste of alcohol became repulsive, and also the bars we hung out in I saw for the first time as ugly, dark, dope dens. And
wow.
He has not had a drink or drunk since then, and that was a number of, decades ago. So that's what interests me.
Yeah, that's
And
that's
I see
crazy.
No reason why we can't move ahead and help people in those situations. Now, I understand there are lots of reasons, but there are lots of reasons for other things we do that are not for people's health either.
What do you think are some of the bigger reasons, though, that Big Pharma hasn't jumped in there and grabbed onto something like this?
Oh, because it's almost impossible to make a profit. The problem with psychedelics is you don't take them very often. The nice thing about what Big Pharma likes is something that should be like milk, which is every day, And if it's an antidepressant or an antispasmodic or a diuretic, and you take it every day, that's a very profitable item, no matter what. Even if you charged a reasonable profit, you'd still be very profitable. Psychedelics don't work that way, and also nobody owns mushrooms, which is one of the major psychedelics. LSD, millionths of a gram. If you make a gram, you've got 100,000 doses. So it's a very different world that psychedelics are part of. They're about learning. And that is just, it's not the medical model. The medical model is you take it, something happens to your body, the effect stops, and you're back to where you were. You take it the next day, and the same thing, assuming it's good for you. And if it's bad for you, the side effects accumulate. Psychedelics are not medical model substances. They're education model substances. It's kind of saying, how often should we read Shakespeare if we want to benefit from Shakespeare? And the answer is, certainly not on a daily basis for the rest of your life.
No. Yes. Yeah, that's something that's very true. Great analogy, actually, on that one. What about, though, for the spiritual side of things? You would think that religion maybe would be interested in this, especially since it brings on such a spiritual. But then again, spiritual is very different from religion.
Well, we all know that religions all start with people having extraordinary spiritual experiences or being extraordinary beings. And just to cause a certain amount of ruffling among the airwaves here, the word Christ actually means something. It's not just a word. It means anointed. It means anointed with oil.
Mm-hmm.
And it is the same word that's used for since the time of Moses, but only for the high priests. And what it says in the Bible is only after you've been anointed do you see the Holy Spirit. And so there is something quite interesting there to look at is what is the basis of our own basic major religion. Most people I know in who are professional religious nuns and priests who've worked with psychedelics, they simply find their own Christianity has been strengthened. And that's true for Buddhists, and that's true within the Jewish community. So these are not anti-religion, but they are anti-dogmatism. People, Houston Smith, who's the world's probably greatest teacher of religious studies, when he first took psychedelics, he said, everything I've been teaching, which I thought was true, meaning he experienced what he had only known before intellectually. And so that's very positive. So I'm waiting for the serious Christians among us to be among the people most supportive of people using these spiritually.
And I think that would hold true then as well for Jewish and even Muslim as well.
Absolutely. Because all of them basically say that we are part of God, that God is within us. And that turns out to be what many, many people simply report when they have a spiritual psychedelic experiences. Aha! That's what people were talking about.
Yeah, and as well, you know, we've had lots and lots of really great leaders and people in this world throughout the ages, actually. You know, writers and other people that we have looked up to as well, and yet we seem to hide the fact that so many of them have come to where they were through a psychedelic experience.
Well, or through other experiences, meaning it's a psychedelic experiences, meaning the emphasis on experience. And people have had similar experiences with fasting. I get regular letters of people that say meditation takes you to the same place as psychedelics used to take me when I was younger. Chanting, dancing, trance dancing. There's just lots of ways in which people historically have said, I need to alter my consciousness to let go of some limitations and to see more clearly how I fit into this whole world, how I fit into my family, how I fit into my marriage, how I fit into my garden. And that's what we're looking at, is these substances are one of the tools that we have available to us, and you know, if you've ever kind of been, done any carpentry, one of the things you quickly learn is there's some wonderful tools for very specific things you need to do. And, yeah, there are other tools you can use, but they're not as good. And so what I'm looking at is like the microscope. You know, do we use the microscope as a doorstop? And they're great doorstops, believe me. But they have this other wonderful use of you can see things that are absolutely unknown to the human eye. And telescopes the same way. And for me, psychedelics seem to be that. Again, more the scientists that I talk to than any other group.
So with LSD and other related psychedelics, you obviously are going to have a whole range of experience, but there are other ways that I hear you talking about as well. That
oh,
you can
absolutely.
Have, yeah, other transformational journeys as well. And maybe we can talk about some of those a little bit more on the other side, especially the ones that where you have some shamanistic guidance with those.
I'd be delighted.
All right, yeah, because those are really of interest to me, especially those types of journeys where you've got shamanism involved. All right, America Now continues with Dr. James Fadiman, Psychedelic Explorer's Guide. Well, we are down in the last segment tonight with my guest, Dr. James Fadiman, and we are talking about his research and his latest book called The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide, Safe, Therapeutic, and Sacred Journeys. Dr. Fadiman, again, let's go beyond LSD, way beyond, as you call it in your chapter, and I'd like you to talk about some of those, especially the ones under the shamanistic guidance. I think that's really something people need to know about.
What we forget in the West, because LSD in particular is a synthetic, and it was made in a laboratory in Switzerland, and there's kind of the feeling, well, there hasn't been anything like that around. But then when you go to Mexico or South America or parts of Asia and parts of Europe, you find out that for thousands of years, indigenous healers have been working with these same substances in an incredibly sophisticated manner. And some of these substances, really, we've only discovered by very kind indigenous people being willing to share their lore with us. And right now, there's there's something called ayahuasca, which is made of two different plants, which you boil them together, basically. And they open up a whole nother realm of experience, which is becoming probably the main area of research going on right now, because these are legal for several churches in the United States who had to fight with the government to get to be legal, but they're legal. And all over South America. And there are clinics using these substances to help people, again, outside of the U.S. So there's a whole world opening up that was invisible to us in the 60s. And we have basically thousands of years of research behind it to guide us. And that's wonderful to be able to suddenly be with people so sophisticated and so well-trained. Shamans have between 10 and 20 years experience, usually before they're allowed to do any work.
Huh?
More than physicians. So it's a wonderful area that we're just beginning to explore, and there have been some what we would call miracle cures of major illnesses with the help of ayahuasca in a traditional setting with a shaman who knows what they're doing.
So what are some of those cures or healings that are happening? For which?
Well, I hesitate because I'm going to get endless letters, but please go to the web before you talk to me. But there have been some remissions from cancer. There's been, in a number of cases, and in a number of cases, there was no remission. There have been enormous changes in mental health. There are basically a number of clinics in Mexico and Peru and in Ecuador that work with addiction, work with cocaine and heroin addiction in particular, but also alcoholism, with a very high success rate, using another substance as well called ibogaine, which is a very, very hard substance to use, and that you really have to want to not be an addict to use it. But there are clinics that allow that to be done in a traditional manner. My favorite clinic has Western physicians and curanderos and ayahuasqueros, meaning people who know how to use ayahuasca. And it's a very severe treatment, but a very high success rate of people actually being able to stop using these substances and lead normal lives. So that's probably the most exciting, and that is available. That's available in Africa, it's available in South America, and eventually it'll be available here one way or another.
Well, you said several churches actually are able to offer this here in
the
U.S.?
There are churches which were formed in Brazil who use ayahuasca as their sacrament, just as Catholicism has a physical sacrament. And these churches, there are two different kinds of churches who have branches in the United States. And they have both won important legal cases where the government says, and I understand the government's problem, the government says, religion, we don't really get in your way. But chemicals and substances, we have to control those. And so when there's a church that has a substance as a sacrament, the government worries about it, and they should. You know, during Prohibition, there was a whole very, very difficult for the Catholic Church to have sacramental wine. So here we're in the same situation with other churches, and in each case, the churches have said, hey, come look at us any way you want, look at our children, look at the way we live, look at our practices, and if you think that we're harming society, shut us down. And in every case, the government has lost embarrassingly in these court cases, where the judge said, what on earth are you doing to these people? This is obviously a religious group. Back off.
With ayahuasca, I've heard said that, and I believe in your book too, you mentioned that the journey, the voyage with ayahuasca is very intense, and that people can actually say they feel like everything's being rearranged, reprogrammed within themselves, including DNA.
Right.
Is there evidence that that actually does happen?
Well, the evidence of reorganization is not at the level of DNA, which is they don't, the next day, you know, start to look like fish or goats. But what they are saying is it feels as if the most profound parts of their way of being in the world are being really looked at, and where there are errors in the programming, that they're being corrected. So it's really like a good software program that says, there are bugs in the way you operate. Let me help you. And literally the feeling is of, very often reported, like tiny little beings coming in and just making repairs. And people then report improved health and certainly improved mental health. So saying it rearranges your DNA is kind of exciting. And again, we have not yet been able to do any research, but it's kind of likely. They still seem to look like people the next day, so probably that's a little over the top.
Well, I would agree with that. It probably would be a little over the top, but just kind of wondering, because so many people talk about these types of things happening. In fact, it could account maybe for some of these people having their alien abduction experiences in certain areas. But may I ask you, since we're down to about the last couple of minutes here,
sure.
What's been the effect on your life?
Of all of this.
You can decline. How has it affected your life?
Basically, I was a perfectly nice, bright, smart-ass, sarcastic, slightly unpopular, nerdish guy. And after psychedelics, I still was all those things, but I didn't do them as much. And I became far more interested in a much wider range of human behavior. And animal behavior and the behavior of stars. I simply changed my whole outlook on what was worth knowing about and have had a career really continuing to explore this wonderful world we live in, which can be found either inside you, called consciousness, or outside you, called the rest of the world. And it turns out that the inside and the outside are remarkably similar. As someone said, you know, we're like a drop of water in the ocean, where we have really access to the whole ocean if we would let go of the edges of our little drop. So that's what I'm studying, and that's what I find a great many people, when I say that, they say, yeah, I know that experience myself, and it really changed my life as well as it changed yours. So I was told very early on that if I did my research as a graduate student in this area, that I would never hold down an academic position. Mm-hmm. And in spite of that, I've taught at Stanford for 8 years. I taught at Brandeis. I taught at San Francisco State University. And I helped found a school, a PhD-granting school, where our graduates seem to be accepted all over the world. So even with that, but it was hard getting those jobs, I will tell you, because my psychedelic research made people nervous.
Well, hopefully at some point they too will open up and realize all of
these
things.
Well, I've also consulted with Lockheed and IBM and the American Heart Association and Weyerhaeuser. So I seem to be able to function in spite of the predictions that anyone who took LSD, you know, would lose their enthusiasm for life or become lazy or sit around and just glow. Doesn't work that way.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you so much. We're out of time here tonight. Dr. James Fadiman, get the book, The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide. All right, thanks so much for joining me. And
oh,
for American...
Barb, what a pleasure.
All right, thanks much. And if you could hold, I'd like to talk to you a little bit here after we're off air. All right, good night from Barb Adams, America Now. Talk to you next week.